Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Wheel Bearings episode 120. This is a special one. Dan and Rebecca are both traveling this week. Actually, I'm traveling. This is Sam Mabul Samad from Navigant Research. I'm traveling too, but we couldn't all get together. But I do have a very special guest this time around, Mr. Edward Niedermeyer, author of Ludicrous, The Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors. Ed, welcome to Wheel Bearings.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So why don't we dive right into this? Ed, you've been writing about Tesla for about 11 years now. What got you started on this?
Yeah. So I actually talk about this a bit in the book because, one of the things I've learned about covering Tesla, from a critical perspective, is that you have to explain your motivations. If you don't explain, you know, why you care, people will make up reasons. And that could be, you know, the fans will make up reasons.
Even if you do, they will still make up reasons.
Yeah, exactly. But even the company has, you know, said that I'm, you know, or implied that I'm working for short sellers or that I am a short seller myself or something like that, which is nonsense. But yeah, so I mean when you say I've written about it for 11 years, I mean that's technically true. One of the things that's been said about me is that I've been basically like predicting their bankruptcy or whatever for nonstop since 2008. So what actually happened is that I started blogging about the auto industry in 2008 for The Truth About Cars. And the main project of that site, for those who don't remember, was documenting sort of the decline and fall of the Detroit automakers. And so we had a GM death watch, we had a Chrysler death watch, and we had a Ford death watch. And these were sort of just a series of you know, kind of editorial length, 1,000-word-ish pieces, sort of just documenting the latest in this long-term decline. So in 2008, Tesla started sort of making more news than it had. And Robert Farrago sort of thought that, who was the founder of Truth About Cars, that we should do a Tesla death watch as well. And so we did do that. And as a freelancer, I wrote a couple pieces for that. But I think it was a handful of pieces that I wrote. And the overall size of the Tesla death watch was tiny, whereas the GM and Ford and Chrysler, like, those were the main projects, and those were the really big ones. So I started – the first time I wrote about it was back in 2008, 2009. Then I kind of stopped. I think maybe I most one post about Tesla a year or something until 2014. I was at Bloomberg View at the time, now Bloomberg Opinion. And when I was there, I wrote I wrote three pieces, I think, in 2014, two of which were actually quite positive, and talking about sort of their moving beyond the franchise dealer model, and then also sort of about how they're sort of able to capture some of the excitement around the changes in the future of the car. And then I wrote one more critical story. And then basically what really sort of launched my real focus on Tesla was in late 2014, they announced a battery swap program. And I did a demonstration. In December 2014, they said it was open to the public. By Memorial Day of 2015, I couldn't find reports that people were actually using it. And so I went down and really on a whim went and checked it out. And what I found was indeed it was not being made available even to people who made the drive between – it's halfway between San Francisco and L.A. People who made that drive regularly said they hadn't been contacted to be able to use it. People said they wanted to use it because the lines were – you know, for the superchargers on a busy holiday weekend were stacking up. And instead of making it available, Tesla brought in extra superchargers and hooked them up to diesel generators. And, you know, just there's something about seeing, you know, the quote unquote long tailpipe of these Teslas being very, very short and seeing the diesel exhaust go up next to these cars and seeing that this battery swap thing was fake. You know, it was one of those moments where I just like, this can't be just a random fluke. There has to be more here. There's never just one cockroach. And so because of that experience, I decided it would be worth investing the time to really dig in to everything that Tesla has done. And, well, the result of those years of not taking anything they said at face value and really just digging in, that's what you can read in the book.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, you know, you mentioned this started with the battery swap program. And, you know, if there's one thing that we've learned over the years, over the past decade, you know, with Tesla fans, you know, whenever something comes out that, you know, is really new and interesting and that the fans, you know, the Tesla customers are really into, they are generally very vocal about, you know, posting online, you know, in forums and on social media, you know, like when the superchargers came out, you know, and then later Autopilot and various other features, they're not shy about sharing their experiences, you know, whether they're good or bad in a lot of cases. Yep. And, you know, for there to be nothing, you know, total radio silence about the battery swap program. And I remember I watched that presentation when Elon announced that, you know, that was a pretty interesting presentation. That, you know, that was one of the relatively early ones. I mean, he had some before that, that all of his presentations have always been a little awkward. You know, he's definitely not a Steve Jobs type on stage, which is kind of interesting. But watching that one, you know, they showed video. I think they had a video of an Audi A8 being fueled up, you know, pulling up to a gas pump and, you know, the driver getting out, fueling it up. And at the same time in sync, they showed, you know, a Model S coming up on stage over their prototype swap mechanism, you know, swapping the battery out, you know, getting a new battery, rolling off the stage. And he said, you know, looks like we've still got some time as the Audi was still being filled up. They pulled another one up and did the same thing again. You know, they swapped two batteries in the time it took to fill the gas tank on the Audi. Yep. And then after that, as you said, nothing happened. You know, what was the story behind that? I mean, what was actually going on?
Yeah. So basically what had happened was that the rules and I sort of found this out once I sort of saw that it wasn't really real. I was trying to answer this question, right? Why do this? And the rules for the California Air Resources Board's zero emission vehicle program had been changed. And basically what that change entailed was, and I think this originally, I haven't traced the roots of this policy change, but I think it had something to do with hydrogen. You know, there's been this battle between hydrogen and battery electric vehicles for position, for subsidies, basically. And basically there'd been this credit added that said, you know, you could double, it's just shy of doubling the number of credits per car if you demonstrate the capability of recharging, like, I think it was like 80% of battery in under 10 minutes or something like that. I don't quote me on the details, but so, and what was interesting about that is that the way the credits were the way this was written, they just had to demonstrate the capability to CARB board members. And I assume they were at that demonstration. I'm not aware of another demonstration of this system. By the way, it was also interesting that demonstration took place. The mechanism, to the extent that there was one, was behind a curtain. And they said it was fully automated, but there was no way of checking that, at least in the context of that demonstration. And so by demonstrating it once to the board members, every car they sold automatically got double credits because it was supposedly, you know, they were capable of it. And what's interesting is that as I was sort of working on this story, I ended up – well, actually, it was a follow-up story. I ended up speaking with some of the policy people, the staff members for CARB. And one of them told me that they had warned the board members that, like, look, you know, the way this policy is written opens us up to be taken advantage of here, right? The point of this extra credit is to incentivize the deployment of new technologies, to solve the problem that battery EVs have, which is that it takes so long to charge. And what the way these policies are written, we're not incentivizing them to deploy the technology. We're incentivizing them to say the technology exists and then never do anything with it. And that's exactly what happened. And what was really interesting is that this staffer was told by at least one board member that, you know what, it's okay. That's not something that we need to fix right away. And I think, you know, anybody is familiar with the interaction between car companies and regulators and lawmakers, you know, local politicians love local automakers, right? It's a big building with a lot of people in it. It's jobs. It's all these other things. And I think it's, you know, it's another example of, you know, you can go into something with the best intentions, but if ultimately one company that you're regulating or passing laws about or policy about is based in your state or your jurisdiction and making a lot of jobs in that area, there's going to always be incentives to sort of, you know, put a finger on the scale in their favor.
Fortunately, we've never had that problem in Michigan. The Michigan state government has never done anything to favor the Detroit automakers.
Exactly.
It's interesting. You know, I think, you know, what they were trying to do is, CARB has had this ZEV mandate, you know, which was pushing the supply side of the equation, you know, pushing manufacturers to build EVs and get them into the marketplace, or build zero emission vehicles rather, and get them into the marketplace. But, you know, part of the rationale for this fast refueling, recharging capability for having those extra credits is to incentivize the demand side, you know, because one of the issues that consumers have had is, you know, like you said, that hassle of having to wait around for a car to be charged, waiting around for, in those days, you know, it was typically hours, many hours, you know, or days in some cases to be charged. Yeah. And, you know, I think they figured if we can get, you know, battery swap capability or hydrogen refueling that you can do in a few minutes out there into the marketplace, that would incentivize consumers to buy these vehicles. So you deal with the demand side as well. Yeah. But, you know, as you said, unfortunately, the way they did the regulation, they didn't go far enough, you know, in terms of ensuring that, you know, it wasn't just a matter of the technology being available, or the technology existing, but that making sure that it was actually readily available. Right. And so, you know, how did that, you know, by giving those double credits for having that capability, how did that actually benefit Tesla?
So it's impossible to quantify because the actual transactions of these credits. So when a company, I think Fiat Chrysler was kind of buying a lot of Tesla's credits at the time, but we don't know what price they were buying them for. So what we do know is that the fine for each credit that you need but don't have, I think it was $5,000 per credit. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but basically when I did do the math, based on that number, so assuming that, and you know, in theory, an automaker would probably pay a little bit less than the fine, because otherwise they could just pay the fine and the money doesn't go to a competitor, although they weren't thinking of Tesla as a competitor at that time. But it was into the hundreds of millions of dollars if you talk about, you know, something close to 5,000 per credit, certainly tens of millions of dollars. And that's really important because, you know, every time that Tesla has shown a quarterly profit, there's not that many times.
I think a total of three so far.
Yeah. Three or four, I think. Because I think there were two last year.
There was only one quarter before that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And anyway, they've always relied on these credits to make their profits. That you take those credits away, and their profitable quarters would not have been profitable, and their losses would have been even worse. And so for me, it was a technological facade that was propping up a financial facade.
Yeah. So, but you know, as you say, you know, in their financial reports, they don't break out how much they get for each credit, but they do. They have broken out, you know, the total aggregate amount of cash they brought in a quarter from sales of credits, and a number of other automakers have bought credits from Tesla because they've had they've had the biggest supply of them because they've sold more EVs than anyone here.
And they sell 100% of the vehicles they sell are EVs. That's really the key. They have nothing to offset with those credits. They have no use for those credits other than to sell them.
Right. So, you know, I think what's interesting about this book, you know, is that it, for the most part, it's not really focused on Elon Musk. It's actually, you know, you're more focused on the company and kind of the company as a whole. And I think, you know, as I wrote in the review I wrote for Forbes, you know, I think that fans of Tesla probably aren't going to like it because you do say negative things about them, but you also give them credit for the things they've done right. Talk a little bit more about, what has Tesla done right in your eyes?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad that people feel that the book does give them credit because, you know, when I started writing this, in 2016, or when I sort of decided to write this book, like right after that, I'd published a story that Tesla had attacked me for in a blog post, and this blog post is still up, and it calls me a short, or implies that I'm short, and it was just very personal, saying that I make stuff up, I made this story up and stuff, and so when I started writing the book, I was pretty angry and pretty like worked up about it. My relationship with the company was really at its low point. And I think what was great about, well, what was good about writing the book, it wasn't always enjoyable, but it was a way to sort of process my thoughts and feelings about the company. And I think that, you know, sort of therapeutic aspect of writing helped sort of, you know, it doesn't take away from the sort of critical points that I make. Those are all, you know, I feel very strongly about those, but yeah, I think it is really important to recognize that they have done a lot of good. It's just that, you know, the good doesn't erase the bad. Right. And so the good is, the drivetrain technology for starters, right. It's just the best. Like there's not better battery electric drivetrain technology out there. They've been able to develop it, very fast. And they've been able to develop their cars very fast, relatively affordably too. Like when you think about what it costs to develop a new platform and a new car, I mean, their development costs are very cheap, and especially for, you know, the sort of performance that they've done. But I think really the core of what Tesla's been able to accomplish is in just reinvigorating the idea of cars. And just the place that cars play in our world, the way I look at it, you know, 50 years ago, 75 years ago, Detroit was to society, American society then, what Silicon Valley is now, right? Which is the sort of preeminent place that if you're a hotshot, you know, that's where you want to go. They're making huge amounts of money. They're on top of the world, doing really well. And critically, they are sort of the part of the economy that is most showing the public what the future is going to be or what the future could be. And I think that, you know, over the last, you know, since the 70s, basically, the auto industry has really lost a lot of that. It's, it's become a much more mature business. And obviously, it's a very competitive business. And the market has also, I think, shifted to some extent, and maybe this just goes along with the maturity of the technology, but to a more sort of commodity business where people buy cars more to get from point A to point B than they do to, you know, symbolize who they are. And what Tesla has done is that they've been able to make a product that you can buy, a car that you can buy, that makes you feel like you're a step ahead of everyone into the future. At least when everything's working well, which is the, it gets into the bad. And I think also it gives people who are part of Silicon Valley, and I think it's easy to forget, there's a lot of people have made a lot of money in this giant technological transformation over the past, you know, 20 years. You can trace it back farther, but and yet there hasn't been a car that if you're, you know, a guy who just sold his startup and for a bunch of money and you want a car that symbolizes you and the place that technology holds in your life and then also in society and in the world, you know, Tesla, people didn't know that that was something that wasn't there until Tesla provided it. And once they provided it, it's like, yeah, how was there not, how were car companies not trying to appeal to techies more before that?
Yeah. And it's fascinating, you know, to see the influence that, you know, this relatively small company, you know, and I say small in terms of, you know, their total share of the market, right, have such a huge, you know, in just 10 years, you know, develop such a huge mind share, and the way that it's influenced the whole industry. You know, in when I, you know, when I first started writing about the industry, you know, when I shifted from being an engineer to being a writer, you know, at that point, EVs, you know, or, you know, we were just coming off of the kind of the first wave of EVs from the original California ZEV mandate. Yep. And, you know, those cars, they were interesting, especially the GM EV1 was, you know, it made some interesting advances, but, you know, we're still relying on pretty old or pretty poor battery technology. Yep. You know, at least in terms of trying to do a full electric vehicle, you know, nickel metal hydride batteries were still comparatively new at that time. And we were using those in hybrids and they worked fine in that kind of application. But, you know, nobody was really using lithium ion yet. And, you know, it was really, you know, the early part of the early 2000s, you know, when I think AC propulsion, you know, really first demonstrated the potential of this, you know, and then Martin Eberhard and then Elon, you know, came along and found, you know, learned about this and, you know, got this whole thing, this whole enterprise going and showed the world that yes, this, you know, the electric vehicle could be something much more than a glorified golf cart. And I think, you know, the EV1 also demonstrated that, but it didn't really have the kind of capability that, that was proven with the Roadster and then the Model S. Yeah. You know, so I think Tesla deserves huge credit for really shifting attitudes towards EVs to something that could really be appealing as a, you know, in the way that cars were appealing in the 1950s and 60s, yep, you know, without even without the environmental part of it, just, you know, looking at here's a car that is fast and good looking and, you know, has some neat features to it. And, you know, that was really appealing and it's on its own merits.
Yeah.
And really has shifted the industry.
Yeah, no, and you know, Martin Eberhard was really, and when the company first started before Elon Musk got involved, it was Martin Eberhard and a guy called Mark Tarpening, and mm-hmm. and Eberhard really did sort of the technical specs for what he wanted the car to be, and while he was working on that, Mark Tarpening did market research essentially, and what he found, and it's one of those things that in retrospect you look at it and you smack yourself on the forehead because it seems so obvious, but at the time in California where they both lived, and these were both guys who had sold, you know, a company that basically, you know, had developed what was the one of the earliest e-readers, and they made quite a bit of money, and they looked around in the neighborhoods they were living in Palo Alto and places like that, and they would see really expensive cars, Porsches and Ferraris and things like that. And they would have a Toyota Prius next to it. And the, you know, the Toyota Prius, if you cast your mind back to those ancient days, you know, there was, that was the green car, right? That was it. And yet it wasn't a car that was designed to appeal to wealthy people and to be a status symbol, really. It was a very Toyota project of like, let's just make a good hybrid car that makes sense and is practical. And I think in retrospect, the fact that, frankly, that Toyota didn't do more to really sort of, you know, position hybrids earlier as a premium thing and as something that really says something about you and who you are and what you value in a car. And then certainly that nobody else saw that opportunity, you know, to build something that was, you know, a clean car, a green car, but that wasn't just a little hatchback or commuter. Because that was the problem with the EV1 and a whole bunch of other cars that were tried, especially early electric cars, is that they were expensive, which everyone thought that was the problem. The problem wasn't that they were expensive, though. It was that they were expensive cars that looked like cheap, crummy cars. And if you just make an expensive car, an expensive electric car that looks and feels like it should be expensive, that was the way to do it. And again, in retrospect, it seems so obvious, but it just wasn't at all. And yeah, Tesla showed the way there.
Yeah, you know, they showed that way, but you know, they at the same time, you know, I think one of the issues, you know, that you point out in the book, and you know, that I've often pointed out over the past dozen years or so, is that you know, it's one thing to take, you know, these new ideas and say, yeah, we need to do these new ideas, you know. And I think one of Elon Musk's fundamental flaws is the idea that you have to do everything from first principles. You know, he constantly likes to talk about first principles, and that's fine up to a point. But you know, as one of the things I learned over the years as an engineer is that first principles only get you so far. You know, when you're doing, you know, you do basic equations in physics, you know, and that's what Elon's degree is. And he's got a degree in physics, you know, not right. in engineering. Yep. And, you know, that they're very different disciplines.
Yeah.
You know, engineering is about, you know, and science, you know, physics and other science areas are about understanding how the world works. You know, what are the principles that make the world work? Engineering is about taking those principles and applying it to solve real world problems. But, you know, one of the things that you find when you go from one to the other is that the real world tends to be much more complex and much more variable than the equations that you learn in a physics class, you know, lead you to believe. You know, you tend to make a lot of assumptions in the science side of it. And, you know, once you get to trying to apply that, you know, now you have to start tweaking things and massaging it a lot. And, you know, when you're doing everything from first principles, you know, it can be valuable to go back and look at what have we done before? What are the lessons we learned before? And how can we avoid having to relearn those lessons? You know, how can we mix that with the good new stuff? And I think that's where, you know, where Tesla has often fallen on its face is, you know, ignoring those lessons of the past. And, you know, one of the areas you get into in the book is, you know, the Toyota production system.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And that's kind of the really fascinating thing to me is that all the people who have been involved in Tesla are really smart, but like that practice of before you get into something, you know, even if you want to do something completely different, at least really do a serious study of how things are done in that business now so that you really understand it. And it's amazing to go back to the history and to realize, even though Tesla's strategy has changed in certain important ways, their lack of really a deep appreciation, understanding of what particularly car manufacturing is has been there all along. For example, you know, now Tesla is a very vertically integrated company, right? So they build their own seats and things like that. And there are a lot of reasons why car companies don't do that themselves for the most part. But back then, in the very earliest days of the Roadster, they had the exact opposite perception. It was like they'd read an article in, I don't know, maybe Automotive News, but more likely something like a more mainstream story about how car companies were putting more work, particularly R&D work, onto their suppliers and the supply chain. And they took from that the idea that they could be, and this is in the original pitch deck for Tesla, is that it is now possible to be a fabless car company. They wanted to be a car company without their own sort of final assembly manufacturing. They thought they could just buy a bunch of parts, and off-the-shelf components. And basically it would all sort of fit together like Legos. And I don't know, maybe contract assemble it or whatever. But like they – and so from that, you know, even though they've changed their philosophy completely – on the opposite direction in terms of vertical integration, what hasn't changed over the whole 15-year history is that they've just been ambivalent about manufacturing. It's just like, it's like, yeah, it's something that we have to do. And in reality, if you look at the history of the auto industry, manufacturing is where things are won and lost. And Toyota, you know, I get accused of being like, I don't know, people say I'm in the pay of Toyota or whatever. Like my perspective on this just purely comes from studying. Why I bring up Toyota so often in the context of Tesla, it's not that everything that Toyota does is good and everything that Tesla does is bad. It's that they're the opposite, they're mirror images, right? They're exact opposite of each other. Toyota has never really been known for having the fastest cars or the sexiest cars or even using the highest technology, the latest cutting edge technology. They've always been behind the curve a little bit on those core things, which are for Tesla, core thing. Tesla's the opposite. They've put everything into design and engineering and the latest technology and the best performance possible. And, you know, so you get totally different things. And I think it's important if you're going to do the exact opposite strategy of Toyota, you know, you have to acknowledge that Toyota went from being a loom maker to like one of the most dominant car makers in the world in a relatively short amount of time in the sweep of automotive history. And you have to have a good explanation for like why things are going to be different for you. And I feel like that study, that due diligence, just never really happened at Tesla. And frankly, if it had, they might not have ever even started the car company.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You know, Toyota, as you said, they tend to be a very conservative company. And you know, even the two areas, you know, where they have been, you know, kind of on the bleeding edge of technology over the last 20 years, hybrids, and then more recently fuel cells, hybrids in particular, you know, both of those were technologies that they worked on for many, many, many years before they ever brought it to market.
Yeah.
You know, the hybrid technology that Toyota introduced in 1997 with the Prius, you know, that was based on a concept that was originally patented back in 1970 by TRW. You know, that whole concept of the power split hybrid,
right?
And you know, it was not ready for prime time. You know, at the time, you know, we didn't have the electronic control systems and some of the other technologies that were needed to really make it viable. You know, and Toyota, you know, picked up on those ideas, and you know, worked on it for many years and refined it before they brought it to market. And you know, by the time they brought it to market, it was working really well, and they've continued to refine that concept, you know, for more than 20 years now. You know, I think they've sold about 7 or 8 million hybrids now over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And
I think this is one of the things, right? So like the Tesla is a little bit of a product of sort of the tech sector feeling its oats, right? They've changed the world so much just in the last 20 years. That, you know, we can get into anything and we can bring our approach into anything and it will do better. And especially, I think they looked at the car companies and they said, they're slow moving dinosaurs, right? They're dragging their feet. This is classic incumbents. And I think they never stopped to ask themselves, like, maybe they move slow for a reason. And I think that's really what the book, in a lot of ways, what I really, one of the big things I try and explain is like, you know, the car industry moves slow for a reason. It's a measure twice, cut once business for very good reasons. And I think we've seen, you know, the good that we've discussed that Tesla was able to bring in, but I think everything that where they've had like real serious trouble has been stuff that's tied to their desire to bring this like super fast pace to the car business, and it just doesn't really fit very well.
Yeah, you know, you talked about, you know, the original pitch deck, you know, and the idea of a fabulous car company, and that really evolves straight out of the way, you know, Silicon Valley software development has evolved over the last 25 years. You know, especially through the 90s, you know, when you started getting more open source software, and you know, startups would, you know, they'd pick and choose, they'd cherry pick libraries and pieces of code from various open source projects and build them together, you know, mash them together in new ways to create new kinds of products, but always in software. You know, and I think, you know, Tesla really tried to do the same kind of thing in building the Roadster.
Yep.
But, you know, obviously when you're talking about a physical product versus bits and bytes, you know, it's a lot more challenging to do that. You can do it. It is possible to do it, but you know, you really have to take into account, you know, even if you're not doing the manufacturing, somebody is. You know, you've got a physical product, somebody's going to have to put those pieces together.
Yes.
And whether you're contracting that out to somebody or doing it yourself, you have to manage, somebody's got to manage all that and coordinate all that. And when you've got thousands of parts coming together, you know, that's a, you know, it's a symphony of things that have to happen in the right sequence, you know, in the right place at the right time in order to get a working product out the door.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's fascinating to me that, you know, Elon Musk continues. I think it was just I think an autonomy day or whatever. Just in the last few months, he said it again, and he says it at least a couple times a year, just like, oh, people don't understand how hard manufacturing and supply chain management are. And it's like, well, no, actually, a lot of people do understand. Like, the people in the business are very aware of how hard it is. And I think it's what you see is that hubris sort of crashing against this reality. And to me, the bizarre part is that he's been saying this for years now, and yet things don't ever seem to change. It's like the culture has taken hold, and it is what it is. And it's like he can't change if he wanted to. And in part, I think part of this also has to do with the financial approach, which is also a very software-centric one, which is that, right, like you can go out and raise a bunch of money for a software company and burn basically all of it developing, you know, your product. And as long as that product reaches a point where you can then start shipping it, right, your additional cost per unit is nothing. It's basically all development cost. And then it's just, you know, control C, control V, you know, chunks of code. Like that's what the manufacturing aspect of software is basically non-existent. And that allows you to manage your finances differently and do this sort of venture capital based system. And I think what's been fascinating too about Tesla is that, you know, they've said, oh, well, we're going to raise all this money and then we're going to make this car. And then we're going to make so much money off that car that we'll go and then we'll fund the next car, right? That was the master plan. And like, again and again and again, they run out of money and they have to go back and raise more. And it has never seemed to occur to anybody that this is a fundamentally low margin business. This is not software where once you amortize that development cost, you're basically making 90% profits or whatever. Like the car business never gets to that point. And so that aspect too. So it's the operational, but then also on the finance side, it's like they keep trying to, it's like they think it's going to suddenly change and all of a sudden these Silicon Valley, you know, approaches are going to suddenly start working. And it's like, guys, this isn't a startup anymore. This is a 40,000 employee company that's been around for 15 years. At what point do we accept reality here?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the interesting lessons that was learned by the auto industry, you know, very early on, you know, the early 20th century, you know, was the idea of standardizing parts. You know, Henry Leland, who's the founder of Cadillac and then later Lincoln, you know, he won the Durer Trophy in, I think, 1906 or 1908, you know, by demonstrating that, you know, they, you know, you could do standardized parts, you know, build a vehicle from standard parts and, you know, service it properly. And I think, you know, what they did was they had, I think it was two or three Cadillacs that, you know, they brought these up, they tore them completely down to parts, mixed the parts around, built the cars back up again from those parts, and all of them worked again. Because they all had, you know, you could take a piston from any one of those engines and stick it in any of the others and it would work, you know, or a camshaft or any other component. And, you know, that's one of the way, you know, Henry Ford then took that, you know, into the mass production, you know, with the assembly line with the Model T, and, you know, then it spread throughout the industry. This is one of the areas that I think actually causes problems for Tesla. They're moving fast and constantly changing things, not only does it cause issues with them, trying to diagnose problems on cars today, but then also it's a problem for providing service parts, and customer support for cars that are already in the field.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And I think one of the other problems with it is that it enables another, or it's hard to say where the causality here is, but it enables a company that wants to bring a Silicon Valley startup approach to this to do what's called minimum viable product, right? Which is where, the product is sort of good enough. Let's just get it out there and we can fix it as we go. And if you understand the manufacturing, because where everything, the more standardized you are, the more efficient it's going to be and the better quality it's going to be. And, in a business that scrapes pennies here and there in order to make profits, I mean, this stuff really, really matters. And so you see these ripple effects up and down. And what's, in the quality, in the efficiency of the manufacturing, in the service, also regulatory compliance is an interesting part of this too, because I don't think regulators can really, I don't know how they determine a population, if a part has gone wrong, or they have reports that a certain part is failing. In any other car company, they can say, okay, well, that part's in all of these model years, and so we know the size of the population, and so we know what percentage of them seems to be having problems, and we can make calculations. If those parts are changing all the time, the regulator can't really do their job either, which is troubling to me. But then, it creates service problems as well. What's fascinating is that, people will say, problems will pop up on the forums going back years now with the Model S, and I'll post about them and on Twitter or something, and people will be like, or I'll write a story about them, and people will be like, oh yeah, that's just a teething problem. This happened with Model S, the Model X, now with the Model 3, it's a teething problem. They'll get over it. And any normal car company, teething problems do happen. That's a fact of life. But because they are standardized in terms of the parts that they use. And then, of course, the parts you use affect the process you use to manufacture too. Because that's all standardized in a normal car company, your people get better, your processes get more efficient, your suppliers are able to keep pace. And it's like a clockwork machine where everything works together. If you're constantly changing stuff, then you may have a process or a system that was causing a problem and you pull all these resources together and train people up and make it work and finally get it going again, which can be painful. And then if something changes, then you can be back to square one again. And so there are problems, with door handles and falcon wing doors and things like that everyone said were teething problems. And now, years later continue to be an issue.
Yeah. Over the years, since Elon Musk took over as CEO in 2008, he has been, I would say, he has been at once both Tesla's greatest strength and perhaps its greatest weakness. The cult of personality he's built around himself, has inspired employees, to do amazing things, and people, people want. Always, they want to go work at Tesla. They want to work for Elon Musk. They want to work on, these changing the world, and making this vision of his a reality, which is great. I'm all for that. Make the world a better place. But many of them often get very disillusioned, in a fairly short period of time. And in fact, I think we just heard today that they've now lost their fifth head of the autopilot program in about the past year and a half. They have an extremely high turnover, but that belief in Elon, is what inspires employees at first and also inspires their, fans and investors to keep putting more money in. Yeah. But at the same time, that his nature, his personality of, needing to be in control and be the, be the micromanager of everything and being the only one that can make this stuff happen, causes that disillusionment and causes a lot of these problems. What What do you think needs to happen with Tesla to really get it onto an even keel so that it can become a sustainable business?
Yeah. So, I mean, just in terms of the sort of Elon Musk leadership part, which, and I really tried to make the book not be about him, because it is so easy to, he's a fascinating guy. And, but you also can't separate him. And I think, there's this question about why Elon does what he does and is he motivated about money and stuff. And really what I found in this book is that I actually don't think that money is his major focus. I think that, but he positioned himself as this central mastermind, Steve Jobs type of figure. Although even Steve Jobs was good at letting other people do the stuff that they were good at. It kind of goes beyond that even. He set himself up to be the hero of Tesla from very early on. When they came out of stealth mode, there were a couple of stories written about the company, two of them at the New York Times. The first one didn't mention Elon at all, and the second one it mentioned him barely in passing as like the money guy. And he was really angry about that, and we have emails that he sent at that time. And he was threatening to fire their PR agency and all this. It was just like he was livid. And within a week or two of that last of those emails being sent, he published this blog post, The Top Secret Master Plan. And I think that to me, it tells me that he's really wanted Tesla to be about him from the get-go. And I think he's clearly someone who really likes the adulation that he gets. And I think by positioning himself as the, indispensable genius that makes this company what it is, he likes that. The question is, that might be good for Elon. Is it good for the company? And I think if you look again at the auto industry, it is the ultimate team sport, really, in a lot of ways. And one of the reasons Elon stands out so much in the automotive landscape is because automakers are such a team sport that to get up to the highest levels, you kind of have to be a team player to some extent. Now, there are egos but there aren't a lot of big, larger than life characters. To me, the fact that this whole sort of dynamic of Tesla being about Elon and about glorifying him, the fact that it's been, central to the company since 2006, that's the part that troubles me. And right. And we saw with like General Motors, for example, they went through 40 years of just decline. And it was extremely hard and it took decades for them to turn their culture around. And I don't know if a company's been around since Tesla's been around from 2003. Elon Musk has basically, had himself positioned as, this indispensable central figure since 2006. And culminating last year with, funding secured, which again is, for him to say that, just say that stuff and there were no consequences internally at the company. It didn't shake the board's faith in him in any noticeable way. There weren't changes. I don't think they can get rid of him. And so I think you're right. I think he is their greatest strength and their greatest weakness. And as time goes on, celebrity stories have an arc where they kind of get built up in order to get torn down. And I feel like there's some of that happening too. And I think that to be a real sustainable car company, no matter which sort of strategy they take for that, I think that, Elon Musk has to at least step back from day-to-day operations, if not potentially leave the company altogether. And I'm not sure that the company culturally can do that, because everybody who's stuck around this far or has been brought in, right, it's they've been people who can't say no to him. And so everybody, the whole culture, right, not saying no to Elon is about as fundamental a cultural value as that company has. And so how do they as a company move beyond him? What is their identity without him? I don't know.
It's going to be a tough challenge. It's going to be fascinating to watch how Tesla develops over the coming years, assuming they survive. And I've actually been one of those people who have long, going back to 2007, I remember talking with my then editor, Sebastian Blanco at Autoblog Green, about Tesla. And, you know, they were struggling at that point. Yep. And, you know, I told them that, you know, I would be shocked if they, you know, made it through 2008 without going bankrupt. And, I've long been wrong about the timing. You know, I still think at some point they will probably need to go through a reorganization.
Yep.
That, you know, that leaves them without Elon. And I think it is possible for the company to survive. Maybe not on their own. You know, yeah. maybe as part, you know, as part of a larger company. You know, but I think Tesla and I think their, you know, their ethos, you know, can and probably should survive.
Yeah.
Because, absolutely. I think they've done a lot of good for the industry.
Yeah. Well, no. And I mean, right. So it's funny because, you know, there's a lot of Tesla fans like to say like, oh, if you thought Tesla was going to go under in 2008, you've been so wrong because look how far they've made it. And like, yeah, like I can certainly admit that, you know, I thought they were going to go bankrupt in 2008 and then they didn't. It doesn't mean I've thought that nonstop. But I think what's really important, and this is a distinction that these people really don't want made, and I think it's important to make it, is that why has Tesla survived? In part, it's because their cars are really good. In part, it's because their drivetrain technology is really good. In part, it's all those things that people love about the car. But really, if you just look at the numbers, right, it's their ability to raise money. Mm-hmm. And specifically Elon Musk's ability to raise money, to go back to the markets, and whether it's bonds or stock, whether it's from venture capitalists in the beginning or public markets now, or the government even in between, that's really what Tesla – that's why Tesla survived. And so, you know, I think to say, you know, oh, you didn't think Tesla would survive and you've been proven so wrong, you know, the reality is that they've never in their entire history had a business that could survive on its own. It's always been their ability to raise a bunch of excitement, and this, of course, gets us to the full self-driving thing, which I'm sure you want to discuss. you know, and they've had to have these escalating sort of big promises in order to raise that money. And I think, to me, one of the reasons I think that we're getting closer to an end game for Tesla is that they're running out of those promises. And I think the absurdity, frankly, of the full self-driving promise it shows sort of how desperate they're getting to come up with this stuff that they can go and raise money on.
Yeah. And, you know, the way that they have been promoting full self-driving and autopilot over the last several years, you know, and I know it's a topic that, you know, you talk about with your co-hosts on your own podcast, AutonoCast, which I forgot to mention at the beginning of this with Alex Roy and Kirsten Korosek. It's a great show, by the way.
Well, thank you.
I think that they have, to me, I think that, that, you know, that they have done a huge disservice to the industry, you know, in the way that they have promoted that technology by, you know, making it seem as if it's a lot closer to reality than it actually is.
Yep.
And also overpromising on the capabilities of what autopilot is today, you know, and we know that that has resulted in numerous deaths. And, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a bunch of statistics, you know, that Tesla has put out there that are of dubious quality, to say the least, because, you know, Tesla is, you know, when it comes to autopilot, you know, is probably the best real world example of the old adage of, you know, tell me which side of the argument you're on and I'll give you the statistics to prove that you're right.
Right.
You know, you can cherry pick any statistics you want, you know, to make a case, but, you know, without the context of, you know, where those came from and what they mean, what is the background of those statistics? You know, it doesn't really mean anything. And I think that's crucially important when you're talking about autopilot. You know, they take, you know, very specific statistics, you know, and don't provide any context, you know, like their claims about, you know, the fatality rate with drivers using autopilot being so much lower than, you know, the population of vehicles as a whole,
right?
You know, which is a meaningless comparison, you know, because all of their cars are relatively new, you know, and, you know, the, you know, aside from the Roadsters, you know, everything that they've got is less than 7 years old. And, yep. you know, the vast majority of their cars are less than 2 years old.
Yep.
And, you know,
they're also expensive. They're
yeah. And they're comparing to a field of 280 million cars, you know, that have an average age of almost 12 years now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, and many of those cars, you know, don't have the safety features that are on, you know, even mainstream modern cars today. So, absolutely. You know, the, you know, what do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that, there, you know, yeah, you have this extreme sense of certainty, both from fans and from the company, that this definitely just makes it's just safer. Like, we just know it. Elon Musk has called people unethical for questioning it and saying that you're killing people by questioning the safety of it. And yet they've never been able to provide really compelling statistics to prove it. And that to me, suggests very strongly that, you know, they don't have, if they have those statistics, you know, the really strong, meaningful statistics, they would prove it. And of course, you also have the example of the whole bizarre and still a little mysterious situation with NHTSA, where they gave NHTSA a bunch of data and NHTSA came away saying that there was a 40% reduction in collisions when autopilot was in use. And through some FOIA work and some really good analysis, these guys at Safety Systems, I can't remember the name of the company, but they proved that it was completely false. And I think when you have multiple instances like that, where you're putting statistics out there, you know, and they're just not true, the question is like, well, why? And I think the other part of this, you know, when I sort of decided to look into battery swap, one of the things that really made me suspicious of it from the get-go was that what made me interested in it was that I'd followed Project Better Place, which is a really fascinating company that was doing battery swap. And what made me suspicious is that, so Project Better Place, their whole thing was they sell you a car without the battery, an electric car with no battery, for $20,000 or whatever it was at the time. And then they basically own the batteries. And you have like a mileage plan, like a cell phone or something. You have a monthly plan, and then you can just keep swapping batteries, and you don't care who's, you know, which battery's in, because you can always just go get a different one, and the batteries are collectively owned. With Tesla, you know, and so there the business model and the technology fit together. And with Tesla, it didn't make sense, because it's like these are privately owned cars. If you take care of your battery and you go and swap it and you get someone else's battery, well, how well has that battery been taken care of? And I think with self-driving, you have the same kind of situation where, even if what they're saying is true, which it pretty clearly isn't, about, you know, what these cars are going to be able to do, their business model does not match up with autonomous vehicle technology. And you can see this because they're having to leverage this alleged or claimed technological advantage. And the way they do it is like these cars are going to go out and they're going to work for you basically when you're not using it. And this is, it's absurd on so many levels. And it's to me, and I write this in the book, this is sort of how I see it, is that they had a deal in 2013 with Google to sell the company to them, because they came in 2012 and 2013 and early 2013. They almost went bankrupt a couple times, or were almost insolvent a couple of times. And they were just burning through their capital because the Model S wasn't taking off. And basically they had a deal with Google, and Google was going to buy them on very generous terms. And they were able to pull off this miracle quarter where all of a sudden their sales fixed themselves, not just in the one quarter, but in 1 month at the end of the quarter, which is interesting to say the least. They borrowed money to pay off the government
loans. Funny how that keeps happening.
Yeah. And you know, then all of a sudden their stock went crazy and they became sort of the Tesla we know today. And they said, okay, Google, we don't want that deal anymore. But right after that, that was when all of a sudden Elon Musk started talking about autopilot and automated driving. And basically, at first it was like, okay, maybe we're going to partner with Google. And then it was like, oh, no, we can do it ourselves, and we're going to offer like 90% of what Google's actual self-driving is going to do. And you know, but it's going to be in a car that you can afford. And I think what this shows me is that you know, Tesla basically realized, or Elon Musk realized, that like electric cars, Tesla created the hot trend in what I would say is the early stages of sort of mobility technology, which is now becoming a very big area. And that was electric cars. But it's not a fundamentally disruptive business. And I think he realized, wait a second, A, Google is farther along on this than we are. B, this technology is more fundamentally and disruptive. Okay, we can debate the details of whether that's the right word, but you get the point. And I think he looked at that and he said, we're going to be the old trend. And in Silicon Valley, you always have to be on trend, right? It's like Hollywood. And I think that, and so if you look at it from that perspective, you know, ever since they've been just trying to tack on this appearance of autonomy onto their existing business of selling high-end cars. And I think that the fact that the business, that those two businesses don't really fit together, especially now that they're going down market. And you're having to sell cars now with, you know, radar and cameras and all this stuff in it, which is still not enough to do full self-driving, but it still adds a lot to the car. It's just a very tortured situation if you sit down and think about it abstractly. And that to me suggests that if it were real and they had the real capability and they knew they were going to have it, why not reboot the business around that instead of just tacking it onto your existing business where it doesn't fit?
Yeah. You know, this has been a fascinating journey to watch this company, you know, since they came out of stealth mode over the last, you know, dozen or so years. And, you know, this has been reading this book and, you know, reliving some of the stuff that I've watched over the years and, you know, getting a lot of new details out of this. You know, it's a fantastic read for anybody that, you know, that's been watching the company and for those that are less familiar with it. And, you know, whether you're a fan or a critic of Tesla, I think it's definitely worth reading Ludicrous. And I want to thank you, Ed, for joining me tonight. So what's next for you after this one?
Well, what's next? I mean,
now that you're going to be a world famous author, you know, number one on the Amazon list and New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Honestly, I have a great situation I'm the senior editor for Mobility Technology at The Drive. That's an area that The Drive hasn't really been in much in the past, and we have an opportunity to sort of create a new approach to covering that space there, and I'm really excited about the potential for that. The Drive's under new ownership as well. And so I think that's a really exciting opportunity. And frankly, it's been very hard to give it my full attention. So it's been hard to give my day job, period, my full attention while I've been working on this book. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. And then of course the Autonocast that you mentioned, I just love doing that show. Alex and Kirsten are great. And I just really enjoy discussing this stuff. So I'm not really looking for anything particularly new. I do hope, though, that the book gets more people interested. I think the beauty of Tesla is that it's getting people who were not interested in cars before interested in cars. And my hope is that the book adds to that and contributes to that, and that more people get interested. And when they are interested, you know, I hope they reach out to me, because I would love to come and you know, whether it's a class or a business or whatever it is. I love talking to people about this stuff. I love answering their questions about this, this stuff. So, you know, my hope is just to continue to make this stuff interesting for people and continue to study it and continue to discuss it.
Well, you keep doing that. And, you know, as I said, I think everybody should take a look at this book, you know, and especially people that, you know, maybe new to the industry, you know, because you said, you know, the auto industry is really fascinating and complex, you know, and it does take a team of people to do this. You can't have just one individual. And I think that there's a lot of interesting lessons to be learned from this, you know, you know, I think people should take from that, and, you know, whether they just want to follow the industry going forward, or whether they're part of, you know, a startup or an established company, you know, they should read this and take some of those lessons and try not to repeat the same mistakes again.
Yeah, that's really what it's about, right? I mean, that's people say, oh, you're so negative all the time. And I've never seen, you know, these sort of hard lessons as being being negative. It's great. And I think, yeah, you know, especially as the tech sector and the auto industry converge more and more, we have to know like which side is good at what. And hopefully what this shows is that, you know, tech companies can be great at certain things and they've really kicked the industry in the ass in certain ways. The industry does certain things really well. And rather than one side disrupting the other, which has been the narrative for a long time, or like this you know, epic battle between Detroit and Silicon Valley, I hope the people take the lesson away from this book that like you actually need both. And that really people need to get over these two industries need to get over their egos and figure out how to work together. I think that's ultimately the real lesson.
Well, and with that, let's call it a show. And thank you, Ed, for joining me, and really appreciate it. And the book is available obviously on Amazon as a hardcover and a Kindle book. Is it also available in bookstores?
It is in bookstores, and an audiobook is in the works. It's not ready yet, but hopefully very soon.
You gonna have Alex narrate it?
I wish. He's too expensive.
Oh, okay. And the book is called Ludicrous, The Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors. And we'll see you next week. Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.